an Iraq war vet on Ramadi then and now. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman. As a Marine, Tom Daley helped U.S. forces take the Iraqi city of Ramadi. Now he says the U.S. should be doing more to help Iraqis take it back from ISIS.
If we allow it to fall and we allow ISIS to connect that Ramadi and Fallujah corridor, we're just going to put that much more pressure on Baghdad.
Meanwhile, in Syria, ISIS has taken Palmyra and threatens its antiquities. This Syrian opposition member says it's a heritage worth protecting.
Saving Syria's past is also about saving Syria's future.
Plus, what's good for monarch butterflies can be a bonus for bees, too.
Good monarch habitat is also good bee habitat. So anything that we do for monarchs will help bees and vice versa.
It's all ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, and for Marco Werman, this is The World. This is probably not what President Obama was envisioning at this point for Iraq. The U.S. is rushing new weapons to Baghdad after a week of ISIS battlefield victories in both Iraq and Syria. Some retired generals here are even calling for U.S. ground troops to be sent in. In Syria, as we'll hear in a few minutes, the so-called Islamic State's forces captured the ancient city of Palmyra and its archaeological treasures. And in Iraq, ISIS is consolidating its hold on the city of Ramadi, which was abandoned by government forces on Sunday. The dismal performance of the Iraqi army has forced Baghdad for the first time to send Shiite militias in to stabilize the situation in Anbar province. The BBC's Ahmed Maher was just embedded with one of those militias. I asked him what made them so much more effective than the Iraqi army.
Well, they're very well equipped. They are reportedly receiving sophisticated weapons from Iran, neighboring Iran. Of course, Iran, they are all Shia Muslims. And also they have this religious zeal in fighting. They are diehard fighters.
So just so our listeners understand, we're talking about Anbar province, a province that goes all the way up just outside of Baghdad. And essentially, these militias, these Shia militias, have been moved from other parts of Iraq to this very strategic area, which is mostly Sunni. So how have they been received as people brought in to fight this fight?
Well, they are definitely persona non grata. They are not welcome at all in the Sunni-dominated province.
But is there a sense among the Sunni civilians in that area, there's a sense of sort of exhaustion, and is there a sense of, okay, we couldn't do it, and we may not like the fact that there's Shias here, but at least there's somebody here to help us get rid of IS. Is there any sense of that?
Well, problem with the Sunni tribes, that they are bitterly divided over the fight or the war against IS, because some of these tribes are supporting the Islamic State militants. They are not swearing allegiance to their ideology, to their unyielding and strict doctrines and interpretation of Islam, but they are doing this as sort of punishing the government, because the government here in Iraq is led by Shia, and the successive governments after the U.S. invasion and occupation, the successive Shia governments, these Sunni tribes say that they were subject to marginalization and discrimination and oppression, and they had many grievances that were not met, according to many of them.
The militiamen you were with, what do they think about the Islamic State?
Well, all Shia militias here do not call the group, the extremist group, Islamic State. They're calling it an Islamic State on the one hand. On the other hand, they're calling it also as Daesh. It's a derogatory term, Arabic term, which shows the deep disrespect and disgust they feel towards the Islamic State group. Of course, there's an ideological and sectarian politics. We are talking about Shia militias fighting Sunni extremists. So sectarianism is deeply felt in this war, ongoing war.
The U.S. has been lending heavy air support in the fight in Anbar province. Does anyone you talk to, military or civilian, want U.S. troops to come back to help with this fight to reclaim cities like Ramadi?
No, of course not. I mean, there's anti-American feeling here in the country, especially among the Shia brigades. So they are definitely opposing to any kind of American comeback to Iraq. So definitely no, the answer no. Whether Shia or Sunni, so anti-American sentiments are running very high here in the country, no doubt.
The BBC's Ahmed Maher speaking to us from Baghdad. As we mentioned earlier, ISIS has been making gains not just in Iraq, but also in Syria. And experts say more and more recruits are joining its ranks every day. They come from all over the world and from a wide range of backgrounds. I checked in with Mia Bloom about this. She teaches at Georgia State University and has written extensively about the so-called Islamic State.
The general type of individual that has joined the Islamic State at the outset, which people may have thought were low-hanging fruit, people who, for example, would buy Jihad for Dummies, or people who didn't know much about the Islamic faith, or people who may have had some stint in prison, is a very different kind of recruit that they've been seeking since July of 2014, when they formally announced the establishment of the caliphate. So now, in the most recent months, they've been deliberately seeking people with expertise. They've been going after doctors, nurses, engineers, people with great skills. And so you've got two very different kinds of recruits, and you also have two very different kinds of messages, because what's going to appeal to the person who has some sort of problematic past is very different from the high-achieving young people that they're looking to get now.
What kind of high-achieving young people are being attracted to the so-called Islamic State?
They're using a lot of some of the same tricks we saw al-Shabaab use in the United States in 2006 and 2007 when they went after the Somali community in Minneapolis. And specifically, they went after people who were high-achieving and smart. One of the boys, one of the 22 who went to Somalia to be a suicide bomber, had just gotten into Harvard. So these are not sort of losers in any capacity. But what they do is a combination of trying to appeal to an almost altruistic sense of empathy for people who are suffering in the region, but also playing on their feelings of guilt, that these people are living this wonderful life in the United States or in Canada, and their sisters and brothers in Islam are dying in the region. And you don't even need the Islamic State to promote this kind of propaganda, because just watching the news or listening to your show, we hear about the horrific things that Bashar al-Assad has been doing to civilians and to Syrian children. And I think that's why you get a lot of this, you can come here and help children. And in fact, Mohammed Abbas, one of the parents of British girls who went missing in February, basically said, I know you want to help the children of Syria, you can help them from here.
So where does the whole idea of becoming radicalized come in? In this group that you're talking about, the educated professional type who are being recruited to Islamic State, do they then become radicalized, or do they go and join and feel like they're fulfilling this humanitarian role without becoming radicalized?
Well, you know, it's a very interesting point. Dr. John Horgan, who wrote the book Psychology of Terrorism, basically has found, after having interviewed over 160 terrorists around the world, that a lot of times the radical views and beliefs actually occur after the person has joined the movement and not necessarily as a precursor. And so it's very possible that people join for, you know, empathetic reasons or for altruistic reasons, and it's only once they become involved are they given that very limited, radicalized view of the world.
Mia Bloom is the author of Bombshell, Women and Terror, as well as other books on terrorism. Thanks so much for speaking to us today, Mia.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's focus now on perhaps the highest profile victory for ISIS in Syria recently. It's the capture of the ancient city of Palmyra and the archaeological treasures there. Syrian-born Amr al-Azam teaches Middle Eastern history at Shawnee State University. He's also an active member of the Syrian opposition. And he says the fall of Palmyra is a major boon for ISIS.
They now hold an important crossroads that puts them on a direct line. If they wish to head towards Homs, they can, or if they wish to head towards Damascus, they can as well. Furthermore, there are important gas and oil reserves around Palmyra that provide the energy necessary for much of the western half of the country, which is where most of the Syrian population lives and also where the regime core areas are. So the regime, having lost those, it means now that in order to continue to keep the lights on, at the very least, they're going to have to buy this energy resource, the oil and gas, from ISIS. On the cultural side, Palmyra is a World Heritage Site. The site is very, very rich, both in content and in architecture.
How many people are we talking about that are now under the control of ISIS?
The current population of Palmyra is around 140,000-150,000. It's probably also a significant number of refugees from other areas that made their way to Palmyra, either from Raqqa or from Homs. And these people are now essentially left abandoned in that city.
You mentioned the famous ruins in Palmyra, and they've really been a big part of your life. You were director of antiquities in Syria just over a decade ago, and I know you've been to that city many times. Describe for me what it's like for you to stand in this ancient city. I mean, imagining that it's not controlled by ISIS at the moment.
You're standing in a city that's actually magnificent. It's a place of great beauty, particularly if you are able to wake up early enough at the sunrise and greet the sun as it hits the Temple of Bel, one of the major monumental features of the site. It was designed so that when the sun hits a certain angle, the entire temple would light up. Or you can walk down the colonnaded route of the city, and the ancient city that is, and you would feel as if you're walking through time. That's what makes the city so attractive. And also its scale, its size, it's all very well preserved by comparison to other sites of the same period.
I know it's always tough when cities like this are taken over and there's a whole debate. There's beautiful ruins there, but yes, there's people. How do we sort of go about saving people and saving ruins? If the U.S. uses airstrikes to hit ISIS in this area, I mean, how would you advise them? I mean, how do you balance the need for the people in this area and the need to preserve the ruins?
The history of Syria, the cultural heritage of Syria, I think is as important as the people, and saving both should be a priority. Remember that this conflict one day is going to end, and Syria's cultural heritage is going to play a very important role in helping Syrians reconcile themselves with their past and act as a way of connecting the various factions and help them rediscover what being a Syrian means. So in a way, saving Syria's past is also about saving Syria's future. But answering your question in terms of what the U.S. coalition can do, this is really the paradox. On the one hand, you know, we want to defeat ISIS. ISIS is considered to be, you know, an enemy. But also the Assad regime is considered to be an enemy. And the United States and the Obama administration has made it very clear that there can be no future for Syria with Assad. So look at the situation you have where by striking ISIS's forces as they attack Palmyra, you're in effect acting in support of the Assad forces fighting to defend the city. This is the nightmare scenario for any administration.
What's the right way to go then?
You cannot defeat ISIS by simply picking your way around the issue. You've got to have a comprehensive solution for the entire region, you know, both Syria and Iraq, because they're all interconnected now.
But those are really big picture things. I mean, in terms of
certainly,
what is the next move in terms of Palmyra, this one city?
I think the next move is survival. I mean, the only hope as I have right now is that ISIS is going to be very busy consolidating its position. So hopefully this means that they won't pay too much attention to the ruins and the cultural heritage there for now. But I think once things settle down and if they do stabilize and secure their hold on the city, then they will most certainly sooner or later turn their attention to it. And then we can start to expect intensification of the looting and also the potential for a cultural heritage atrocity, not too different from that seen in the Museum of Mosul in Iraq or the sites of Nineveh and Hatra.
Syrian-born Amr al-Azm teaches Middle Eastern history at Shawnee State University. Thank you so much, Amr.
Thank you.
Coming up later in the show, a veteran of the surge in Iraq who served in Ramadi on what it's like to hear that ISIS now controls the town. That's still ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Carol Hills with The World. There's a big trade deal in the works called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP for short. The U.S. is negotiating it with 11 other countries. Together, they represent close to a billion people and 40% of the world's economy. Supporters say the deal would change the way the U.S. and the world does business for the better. Critics say it's a sellout to multinational corporations. The World's Aaron Schachter gets some help from economists to break it down.
Yeah, I know what you're thinking. Trade deals are about as exciting as watching grass grow. And maybe you're also thinking, wait a minute, why haven't I heard of this thing?
If you haven't heard much about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that's part of the problem right there.
Robert Reich, Secretary of Labor under President Clinton, breaks down the TPP in a two-minute online video. He says the clock is ticking on a bad deal negotiated in secret.
In other words, it's a Trojan horse in a global race to the bottom, giving big corporations from Wall Street banks a way to eliminate laws and regulations that get in the way of their profits.
Reich is now a professor of public policy at UC Berkeley, and what you heard from him is pretty much the argument all critics make. Bad deal for working people, written behind closed doors by fat cat corporations. But talk to economists and you get a different story. Almost invariably, they say, free trade deals are good for everyone in society.
Liberal, Democrat, conservative, Republican, overwhelmingly, we agree on the benefits of free trade.
That's Jeffrey Frankel, a self-described liberal from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. And this is Derek Scissors, an admitted free market nut job with the American Enterprise Institute.
It's really hard to find economists who don't like free trade because they think the government is less effective than people are in making choices for themselves.
Free trade, these guys say, doesn't benefit one industry over another. Economist Jeffrey Frankel says American businesses export a lot of things and they employ a lot of people.
We export educational services, medical services, construction companies and architects and financial services and software programmers and tourism.
Also lots of agricultural stuff from corn and livestock to lawn tractors and huge harvesters. Oh yeah, sure, detractors would say. Some corporations would make out just fine, but not the little guy. And this is what really gets the economists hot and bothered.
There's always some people who will lose their jobs from it, just like from technology or any other source of growth or change. There's winners and losers, no question about that. But I do believe that it's good for Americans as a whole. I even believe it's good for working class Americans and, you know, middle class Americans. I don't believe that it's only good for the rich or for corporations.
Free trade has helped the poor and helped the middle class. Clothing in the United States used to be expensive. It used to be expensive because we didn't want to let in foreign textiles and foreign apparel because we were protectionist about it. We get cheaper food year-round because we import food from other countries in off-seasons. That also disproportionately helps the poor.
Scissors and Frankel agree on a couple other points as well. First, no one really knows yet exactly what the Trans-Pacific Partnership looks like. So railing against it or singing its praises is just so much hot air. And the charge that this is all being done in secret, that does look really bad. But Frankel points out, of course it's being done in secret.
When you're negotiating, you can't say what exactly the outcome is going to be. And you can't even say, you know, what your opening bid is going to be and what your fallback position is going to be or what, you know, what your bottom line is. You can't reveal those things in public. It's inconsistent with the nature of negotiations.
And here's another thing that's driving TPP critics nuts right now. President Barack Obama's request for fast-track authority. That allows Congress only to vote up or down on the treaty. Lawmakers can't debate it or offer amendments.
We don't do this in any other part of government.
Alan Grayson is a Democratic congressman from Orlando, Florida. He spoke on Acronym TV, an online news site.
We don't do this on a tax bill. We don't do this on an appropriations bill. We don't do this on a Social Security bill. We don't do this on a Medicare bill. We don't even do this on gun control bills, okay? Only for trade.
That sounds pretty damning. But economist Jeffrey Frankel says, consider the alternative.
There used to be this routine practice that the U.S. Negotiators get their best deal, and they tend to get a lot. And then President brings it back to Congress for approval, and Congress says, well, no, now we're going to require some amendments, otherwise we won't agree. And we did that enough times that other countries said, we're not playing this game anymore. So ever since Nixon, we've had to have fast-track authority where Congress votes thumbs up or thumbs down.
Fast-track authority cleared a hurdle today in the Senate, but lawmakers are still roiling about the Trans-Pacific Partnership itself. They've pledged to force in a host of amendments, including one that demands any trade deal address currency manipulation. For The World, I'm Aaron Schachter.
Here's another issue that comes up for debate in the U.S. whenever a new free trade agreement is being considered: poor or even abusive conditions for workers in developing nations. Critics here often push for amendments that would protect workers abroad. A similar push is underway to force the organizers of the 2022 Soccer World Cup to improve labor conditions in Qatar. The tournament is still 7 years away, but already hundreds of thousands of migrant workers are there building stadiums and all the infrastructure. And the government of Qatar has been heavily criticized for allowing those workers to be abused and exploited. They don't like people talking about it either. On Monday here on the show, we heard from a BBC colleague who went to Qatar to report on this and wound up in jail. Today, there's an update on the bigger picture, and the world's resident soccer guy, William Troop, is here to fill us in.
Yeah, hi, Carol. Today, Amnesty International issued a report that says Qatar is failing to do enough to treat these workers right. And that's despite a promise by Qatar last year to address a variety of ways in which workers are being exploited in the country. Everything from harsh working conditions, especially in the heat that is the norm in Qatar, to the practice of withholding pay from workers or confiscating their passports so they can't leave when they choose to. Amnesty is not saying that there haven't been any improvements on these issues, but the report does accuse Qatar of promising very little and delivering even less.
So how's Qatar responded to this report?
Very carefully. This is a very serious issue for Qatar, and it goes beyond the build-up to the World Cup. There's a huge building boom in the emirate, fueled by oil money, and a very small indigenous population, so not a lot of indigenous workers. So the estimated 1.5 million migrants from countries like Nepal, Bangladesh, India, the Philippines, these guys are key to the emirate's plans to literally build itself up. So Qatar's response today has been careful. They say they're making a big effort to improve conditions for migrant workers, changing the law to get them paid more efficiently, for example, or building new housing for them. But Amnesty and other critics say that's just not enough. Here's what Amnesty researcher Mustafa Kadri says.
Workers are not free to choose their employer, to change their employer, to leave the country at will. The employers have this phenomenal power over their employees. Our complaint is that none of these key problems have been addressed by the Qataris, despite now being 12 months since they promised to begin to resolve these problems.
Okay, so Amnesty International says Qatar isn't improving conditions for migrant workers fast enough, but what about the soccer tournament itself in 2022? What's going to happen with that?
Well, my guess is that it's going to happen. The governing body of soccer, FIFA, remains committed to it, and FIFA is notorious for being very slow to change its mind on anything. In fact, the accusation is that the only thing that influences FIFA is money. And that might be the key, actually, because this week, two big World Cup sponsors, Coca-Cola and Visa, actually spoke up about labor conditions in Qatar and urged FIFA to do more to push Qatar to improve those conditions. And, you know, if it's true that money talks when it comes to FIFA, I think FIFA will respond to this and try to at least look like it's doing something about it.
The world soccer guy, William Troop. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Lalo Alcaraz already has an edgy comic strip called La Cucaracha. Now he's going to write comedy for Fox.
When I walked in the first day, I told them, if I seem awkward, it's because I've worked as a cartoonist alone for 25 years in my own room. So please bear with me.
That's ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with support from Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. You can learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Most American troops have been out of Iraq for years now, and for many of us, that's meant we pay little attention to what's happening there now. But it's different for those who served there. Their memories of Iraq are tied to the places they fought to conquer and protect. So when there's news that ISIS has taken over a place like Ramadi, it can be difficult for veterans like Tom Daley to hear. As a Marine, Daley helped U.S. forces take that key city in Iraq's Anbar province. He wrote a book about his experience as a lieutenant there. It's called Rage Company, A Marine's Baptism by Fire. Daley still remembers arriving in Ramadi in November 2006 as part of the surge to push al-Qaeda from Anbar province.
My memory of downtown was more Stalingrad-esque. It was destroyed while I was there. And the images that came out of the city over the years after were completely different. They rebuilt many portions of the city. We had torn down a series of structures that overlooked into the government compound in the center of the city because the insurgents were using them to fire at the Marines at that position. And the Iraqis had rebuilt a garden with a statue that symbolized peace for the city. They were incredibly grateful for us for helping them remove al-Qaeda from the city. I mean, it was a brutal, brutal fight in downtown where people's kids were being kidnapped and beheaded, sheer brutality. So the people really rejected that extremism.
What you describe so powerfully in your book is not Marines riding into the rescue, but the careful and often dangerous effort that it took to build an alliance with the local citizens. Why was that so difficult in Ramadi?
It had a lot of support for the Ba'athist Party. These were the guys that were sort of in charge, same people that I probably envisioned that I needed to kill when I first went to Iraq. And when you look at the dichotomy of al-Qaeda and these Sunni nationalists trying to fight America together, it just wasn't a recipe that was going to work. Al-Qaeda tried to force themselves upon the population, and in time it became something that we were able to exploit during my time there, was working with these Sunni nationalists who recognized that America had a lot more to offer Iraq than what al-Qaeda did.
So who were these Ramadi residents that your company worked with?
Well, we called them the Scouts when we first started working with them. They were really a mix of former military, Ba'athist, infantry, pilots. Some of them were lawyers, you name it. And in time, as the populace saw us become more effective, the group really exploded into literally everyone. It became a popular movement and something much more than just this core group we originally started with.
Why were these Sunnis so eager to deal with the Americans?
We almost messed this up. When we first started working with these guys, they came to us and they had, you know, literally they just showed up and said, we want to work with the Americans who are in our area. And there was no trust. Let's start with that. We tried to take the weapons away from these Sunnis. We demanded that they go out with us unarmed. They refused. We told them that there were no trucks to take them home, so they would have to stay with us the night anyways. They might as well go with us. And so we went through this whole kind of back and forth where we eventually gave them the weapons and we let them come out with us, and we did this first mission together. And the first time we did this, we had a total of 25 guys. And the second time we did it, 5 of them came back. So it was not something that looked promising at the time. But the moment the locals saw that we were effective, we were kicking down the right doors, grabbing the right people, putting them away, which then allowed the citizens to have confidence in giving the Americans information, which was something they had not had.
Now, one of those citizens was a Ramadi resident called Abu Tiba. Tell us about him.
Yeah, Abu Tiba was a lawyer, and I did quite a bit of work with him as a kind of the liaison to these guys that we were referring to as the Scouts. In time, he's risen through the ranks. He's now a chief of police in Eastern Ramadi, and he's on the front line with ISIS today. I mean, this is a guy who had envisioned his dream in life was to see Niagara Falls in New York. You know, he lives in a desert. The one thing he wanted to see before he died was water in abundance. So it was a very personable guy. And, you know, I've maintained contact with him through the years.
Have you been in touch with him in the last few days?
No, not for the last 2 weeks. The last email I got was from Abu Tiba, and it was 2 weeks ago. And he said that we have achieved nothing.
So do you think that those people feel sort of abandoned?
Absolutely. And really, the Sunnis, will they forgive? That's the ultimate question. The Sunni tribes in Ramadi are the fiercest anti-ISIS tribes there are. That's why this is such a symbolic victory for ISIS. If we allow them to control that city, they really have no one opposing them in Anbar province. You know, the people might not like what's happening to them, but they're killing off the opposition. Literally, killing off the opposition. So who is it that the government in Baghdad is going to partner with?
Author Thomas Daly wrote a book about his experience as a lieutenant in Iraq's Anbar province. It's called Rage Company, A Marine's Baptism by Fire. Thanks so much, Tom.
All right, Carol, thank you.
Tomorrow, voters in Ireland are expected to legalize same-sex marriage. That's what the polls say. And it signals a big shift for the staunchly Catholic nation, as the world's Matthew Bell reports.
The Irish Constitution itself reflects the country's deep Roman Catholic roots. It was drafted with input from the Archbishop of Dublin and presented to the Vatican for review. And while the Church's hold has been slipping, Ireland remains a solidly Catholic country. So it's no surprise that some of the people who spoke with the BBC after Mass in Galway on Sunday mentioned their faith when explaining why they would vote no tomorrow.
There's no such thing as constitutional rights for gay marriage. Divine law is above civil law. It predates the church and the state. It's there from the very beginning that we were created male and female. And a man and a woman united together is what a marriage is. And anything else is something else. So I think it would be a very black day for Ireland if the yes vote wins.
Unless the polls turn out to be very wrong, the yeses are going to win. They've been bolstered by a media campaign with Irish celebrities, sports stars, and politicians, including Prime Minister Enda Kenny. He's a church-going Catholic himself and says he's got no problem reconciling that with his support for same-sex marriage.
Society has moved and evolved. You had the same headlines when divorce was introduced 20 years ago. Marriages have increased. Now you have a situation where the question about extending that equality to all citizens is what people will answer on Friday. And that's why I'm voting yes.
It was Irish voters in 1995 who overturned the constitutional ban on divorce. The Catholic Church was opposed to that amendment, but it passed by less than one percentage point. The current Archbishop of Dublin concedes that the influence of the church continues to diminish in Ireland. Dermot Martin had refrained from doing interviews until the final days of the campaign. Last night, he sat down with RTE, Ireland's national broadcaster, and the Archbishop was asked if Catholics can indeed vote yes in good conscience.
I don't tell anybody how to vote. I think the days when bishops tell people how to vote is long since gone. But with the other bishops, we've constantly said, look, this is not a simple thing. It's not simply about the love of two people. It's about something that's more fundamental for the stability of society.
Martin said this is about protecting the definition of marriage as the union between a male and a female. But Catholic doctrine still calls homosexuality a disorder. And the Archbishop was asked if that's something the church ought to be embarrassed by in this day and age.
The teaching and the practice of the Catholic Church and of broader society in Ireland have been very harsh towards gay and lesbian people. I believe at the synod that Pope Francis called last year, there was a lot of discussion on the place of homosexual people with homosexual orientation in the Catholic Church, and a clear openness to frame that teaching in a different way. But it was also very clearly and unambiguously said that marriage between two people of the same sex is not the same as marriage between a man and a woman.
More than 90% of the Irish population identify as Catholic, but just a third of them still go to church every week. And that's due in no small part to two decades of child sexual abuse and cover-up scandals. Tony Flannery is a Catholic priest from the west of Ireland. He was suspended by the Vatican in 2012 for openly defying church teachings. Flannery says he's one of a handful of Irish priests who've said publicly that they'll go against the church's wishes in Friday's referendum.
I'm voting yes. I'm not gay myself, but I have a lot of friends who are gay, and I've listened over the years to gay people, and this country has been a very unwelcoming place for young gay people growing up. If this referendum is defeated, it will be yet another serious kick in the teeth to gay people.
And if the no's do manage to pull off a surprise victory, Flannery worries that people in Ireland will blame the Catholic Church, especially younger people. And that will only further damage the reputation of the church in this most Catholic of countries. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Lalo Alcaraz has a lot of titles: cartoonist, artist, satirist, radio host. His long-running daily comic strip, La Cucaracha, is the first nationally syndicated, politically-themed Latino comic strip. And now Lalo's set to hit the small screen as a writer for the new Seth MacFarlane animated comedy, Bordertown.
Welcome to a town at a cultural crossroads. This is Mexifornia.
We've got a Native American, an Asian couple, and I even managed to find a white guy.
Is that some kind of insult? We're still in charge. We still have the vice presidency.
The show is set to debut next January on Fox and centers around two families living in a southwestern town. We'll let Lalo describe the main characters. He's speaking to us from KPCC in Pasadena. Lalo, who are they?
Well, the two main characters are Bud Buchwald, kind of a befuddled border patrolman, probably the worst border patrolman
in the whole North American continent, and he is just kind of a knucklehead in the Homer Simpson, Peter Griffin mode. And he cannot stand his neighbor, a Mexican immigrant, Ernesto González, who has been in the U.S. for 20, 30 years and is doing way better than Bud Buchwald.
Is Bud Buchwald, is he sort of an updated Archie Bunker?
He definitely, and that's like the in-joke inside the show because, you know, that's the departure point for that character. The world is moved past him, and he cannot comprehend what's going on. And so a lot of the comedy comes out of that. You know, the show is set in a border town, but it's really the metaphor for the changing demographics of the U.S.
Now, another Seth MacFarlane show, Family Guy, it's known for being kind of an equal opportunity offender. Who do you expect to offend with Border Town?
Well, you know, if there's a group called the Redneck Anti-Defamation League, I think they would be interested in being against this show because there's a lot of jokes about that. But that's like anything on television. But I think people that are very sensitive about comedic representations of Latinos, they might not want to watch this show because the show is very funny. My job on the show really is, I mean, I am a consulting producer and a writer on the show. And I've been doing, you know, political satire for 25 years at least. And I think I know my way around the Latino topic and the immigrant topic.
I was wondering because, you know, as a cartoonist and satirist and the various things you do, you kind of work on your own. You choose your own topics. You choose how far to go. Has there been any challenges to working in a group and sort of finding consensus in how to do this?
Oh, well, it's a new experience. When I walked in the first day, I told them, if I seem awkward, I told the whole room of comedy writers, if I seem awkward, it's because I've worked as a cartoonist alone for 25 years in my own room. So please bear with me. Human contact, something new for me.
I wonder how your own upbringing influenced your decision to get into kind of satire in general. I mean, you've studied art, you've studied architecture. You're as much of an artist as anything else, but you've chosen political satire. Why that?
I grew up an angry young cholo growing up on the border in San Diego, California. And I grew up seeing how my Mexican immigrant parents were mistreated and taken advantage of by their bosses and by the system. So I grew up angry and not really focused about why until I met Chicano artists and I met teachers that helped me focus my energy and my rage into using my natural ability to draw and write.
You mentioned you've been doing satire for, you know, like 25 years, much of it on kind of Latino issues and immigration issues. Do you ever find yourself kind of confronting the same issue you dealt with 25 years ago, but in a different way?
Oh, gosh. I mean, when the Arizona SB 1070 Show Me Your Papers law came up, I mean, that was just a replay of the Proposition 187 law from 1994, you know, and yeah, it's a little frustrating when you see these things. Sometimes you feel like, what am I doing this for? But, you know, sometimes I feel like I'm just trying to shed light and that's all you can hope for.
But the fact that you're now writing for a Fox animated comedy, doesn't that say something about where these issues are? You're not just the alt comic, you know, in Southern California.
Yeah, you know, a few years ago when people started talking about immigration every day as a news story, I mean, that was a moment for me. I realized, like, yeah, you know, I mean, immigration has always been a historic topic and a news topic, but now it's every day. And something has changed, you know, where there's a big shift in this country. It's a new reality. So I'm happy that I'm still alive to be able to engage in the mainstream.
Lalo Alcaraz is a satirist, syndicated cartoonist, and now a writer on the upcoming Seth MacFarlane comedy Border Town on Fox. Thanks so much, Lalo.
Thank you, Carol.
You're listening to The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings and legal plans featuring attorney contract review and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. A few weeks ago, there was an outcry in Poland because a Russian motorcycle gang known as the Night Wolves wanted to travel there. The Night Wolves call themselves outlaws, but they're actually tight with Russian President Vladimir Putin. And their motto is, wherever the Night Wolves are, that should be considered Russia. So you can understand why other countries don't want them to visit. Writer and NYU professor Mark Galeotti wrote about the Night Wolves and their close relationship with the Kremlin for the Moscow Times.
They're not necessarily the typical stereotype of the outlaw motorcycle gangster. Their head, Zaldos Stanov, actually was a former cosmetic surgeon. They're a mix. In part, they're wannabe bikers. In part, they are real thugs. But the main thing is that really they represent the kind of person who wants the thrill of being, of feeling like a biker with all the studded leather jacket and everything else, but doesn't actually want to run up against the state. They are kind of house-trained, safe outlaw motorcycle gangsters.
So we're not talking kind of a Russian Hell's Angels?
Not really. They look it. When you first see them, precisely, they're long hair, big studded leather jackets, massive chromed motorcycles and such like. But when you actually look at what they do, it's always with an eye to the Kremlin's favor.
How did their connection to the Kremlin start?
Well, when they first formed, way back in the 1980s, they were a counterculture group. But through the 1990s, they became increasingly really informed by quite nasty nationalism, even racism. And when Putin came into power, and the sort of the mood, the ideology of the nation changed, increasingly the Night Wolves actually fit in with that. Putin himself first came across them in 2009. He went and visited one of their garages and a very sort of carefully planned photo op. And it's been clear that basically from that point, there was a sort of a perfect little marriage. Putin likes anything that helps him foster his macho bad boy image. And obviously going for rides with motorcycle gangsters works for that. And likewise, the Night Wolves got a patron that gave them a lot of freedom, a lot of liberty, and actually a lot of money. I mean, more than $1 million so far in grants have been allocated to them.
But besides the money, what's the appeal of Putin to the Night Wolves?
Well, in a way, Putin embodies so much of what they wanted to see in the Kremlin. He's an outspoken Russian nationalist. And, I mean, again, I mentioned this chap, Zaldos Stanov, who heads the Night Wolves. And for a long time, he has been campaigning for Crimea to be brought back to Russia. So when they have a leader who finally does that, they think it's their dream come true. Secondly, it gives them a lot of freedom. We've had cases in which Night Wolves have, for example, clashed with rival gangs. In one case, actually, there was a fatal shooting. The Night Wolves always seem mysteriously to get let off, whereas the other gangsters end up going to prison. So this is something that basically means the Night Wolves get to have their fun and yet not have to worry about the cost.
Are there any dangers for Putin of hitching his political wagon to a motorcycle gang?
Well, apart from looking increasingly ridiculous as he gets older and older, there's a limit to how old you can be and wear a leather jacket and pull it off. Not really. I mean, the Night Wolves, they're not that huge or powerful an organization. It's not like they're ever going to become a tail wagging the state dog or anything else. It's more that the increasing way that Putin relies on groups like the Night Wolves, like the militias that are fighting in the Donbass, who are kind of sort of under state control and sort of not. It means that actually he gets deniability, but he also has less real control.
Mark Galeotti wrote about the Night Wolves in the Moscow Times. Thanks a lot, Mark.
Pleasure.
Finally, the U.S., Canada, and Mexico may share borders and trade agreements, but a new plan announced yesterday by the White House would have the three countries cooperate on butterflies and bees. Honeybees and monarch butterflies in particular are threatened. Their numbers are crashing. So one part of the proposed conservation plan is to create a butterfly corridor across North America. Karen Oberhauser is a conservation biologist. Karen, what is a butterfly corridor?
So we're calling this the I-35 corridor, but it's not just I-35 and the land on either side of the highway. It's land going out hundreds of miles on either side. So if you basically think just of a broad swath of land coming up from Texas and going through the middle of the United States, that's what we're thinking of, because we know that that is where most monarchs come from that migrate to Mexico in the fall. and where most of them breed.
So would Mexico be creating the same kind of corridor and Canada so these butterflies could wing their way north and south each year safely?
Yes. Mexico has actually been focusing for a long time on conserving the overwintering spot. So there's a strong push to stop logging the overwintering sites in Mexico and a more recent push to focus on the migratory pathway. So it's definitely a focus in Mexico as well as in the U.S. and Canada.
The drop in the monarch population is really staggering, 90% drop of monarchs heading south. Have scientists been able to really zero in on what is causing this massive drop in population?
It's sometimes a little disheartening to think of all of the things that are threatening monarchs and bees and a lot of other species. Probably the biggest one is habitat loss. And what's happened recently is there actually used to be a fair amount of milkweed, which is the host plant for monarchs, growing in cornfields and soybean fields. And these milkweeds were used by monarchs, but with the advent of herbicide-tolerant crops, that milkweed has disappeared. So that's been a big driving factor, but we also have insecticides that are being used, mosquito control agents. Climate change is probably playing a role. So there are lots and lots of factors that are contributing to this.
Now, you mentioned bees, and this announcement does apply to bees as well. What about this corridor will help in restoring their populations?
Well, the stated goal is to protect 7 million acres of habitat. And basically, good monarch habitat is also good bee habitat. So anything that we do for monarchs will help bees and vice versa. So creating habitat that has the nectar sources and the nesting resources that these bees need will have huge benefits for them and for monarchs.
Are Canada and Mexico taking their own initiatives on this corridor?
Yes, this is a trilateral initiative. So it all started when Presidents Obama and Peña Nieto and Prime Minister Harper met in Mexico last February of 2014 and agreed to protect monarchs. So all three countries have big initiatives right now. So we're really heartened by this.
Any suggestions for our listeners on how they could attract honeybees and butterflies?
Yeah, there are lots of things. Anybody that has any land at all, even a yard, the nice thing about butterflies and bees is they can use very small pieces of land. So, you know, a 10 by 10 foot garden or larger is always better, but you don't need a lot of space to put in flowers, sources of nectar for bees and butterflies, and milkweed plants, which are the food for the caterpillars. People can also get involved in monitoring monarchs. There are all sorts of great citizen science programs that monitor monarchs when they're caterpillars, when they're migrating. Really anywhere people are, they could go out and monitor monarchs.
Karen Oberhauser is a conservation biologist at the University of Minnesota. Thanks, Karen.
Great talking with you.
What was it Muhammad Ali used to say? Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for tuning in.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. The PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter Berge and Debbie Sitt, and Cindy and Howard Rachofsky. By the Ford Foundation, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs. By the Annenberg Foundation, Advancing a Better Tomorrow Through Visionary Leadership Today, annenbergfoundation.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.